Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Women Leading Healthcare Innovation and Family Recovery, with panelists Carolyn Gamicha, Mary Romanis, and Marsha Hines. Our moderator and host for tonight is Dr. Robert L. Hendren, professor of psychiatry at the University of California of San Francisco. He's also past executive director of the Mind Institute at UC Davis, and he is also past president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Dr. Hendren will give us a brief opening, some nice opening remarks to set the stage, and then he will introduce each of our panelists for tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here among a small group of passionate people for a cause that I think we all have strong belief in. The mother of one of my patients with autism a number of years ago asked me, what do you think is the best prognostic factor for somebody who has autism? And I thought, you know, is it IQ? Is it language? Is it maybe some kind of adaptive structure, function? And as the more I thought about it, I said, you know, the most important thing that could happen to somebody with autism is that they have a parent who's a really good advocate. Mm. And I think tonight we're fortunate to have three really excellent advocates talking about their stories. And while there are a number of places where the stories are similar, there's a number of places that they're different. And they'll tell us about the things they've written and the things that they've done. And we hope that in that process it stirs up thoughts that you have so that we can have a lively discussion with the group of us who's here to be able to do that, and I'll try to help feed it as well. The other brief story I'd tell was that when I was being interviewed to be the executive director at the Mind Institute, as you might know, the Mind Institute was founded by four families who had children with autism. They were so unhappy with the way they got their diagnosis, unhappy with the prognosis they were offered, that they said, we're going to change that. We're going to do something to make it different. So when they interviewed me, the comments that they made or started with is, we want you to leave no stone unturned about what might be causing autism and how it might be treated. We want you to do good science, but we want you to keep an open mind. And it was a pleasure to always kind of keep that mantra in mind as they said that to me, because there were times I'd go to meetings that people told me I shouldn't go to, and that I went and tried to learn about things that people said, that's not good science. But it led me into different things that I see each of these passionate moms have been led into as they were trying to find ways to make the world better for their children. And there's nothing more moving to me than seeing a parent, especially a mom, that's fighting for their kid. And I think you'll hear that story tonight. Our first speaker will be Mary Romanis. How did I do? Was I close?
Not bad.
Not bad. All
yeah,
right.
Actually, the relatives in Colorado pronounce it that way.
Well, I'm getting close. Who wrote a book, Victory Over Autism. It's she is a reporter. She's the mother of a child who recovered from autism at the age of four. Her articles have appeared in a wide variety of magazines and journals like Mothering Magazine, Autism, Asperger Digest, Autism Today, and Journeys Magazine. The book is a wonderful book with thoughtful advice for families as they're working for the whole family's recovery and strength and ways of pulling things together. So as we're going to go through each of them, I'm going to introduce them. Then each of them is going to tell you a few minutes worth of what their book's about so that you can be thinking about questions you have that you'd like to ask more of. Our next speaker is Marsha Hines. She's the author of I Know You're In There. It's a great title because I can't tell you the number of times I've thought about this kind of veil that comes over a child with autism and How can you reach in and grab them and pull them out? And Marcia describes a number of ways of doing that. And it's not just with any one particular technique, but it's finding your way under that tent or under that veil and finding the person there to pull them out. And she does a marvelous job of talking about that. And our final person batting cleanup, so to speak, is somebody that is a fierce advocate, Carolyn Gamachia, who is the executive director and co-founder of Lean On Us. She's an advisor for the National Center of Criminal Justice and Disability. She's a consultant for the disability advocate and activist and a former law enforcement professional. That's why I told you she'd be good at batting cleanup. But over two decades in the field, she's the proud mother of two sons, and I believe some of them are here tonight. So we'll go through each person, spending maybe 3 to 4 minutes. If I say that, I know that'll be 4 to 5, and we've all agreed that if they get too passionate and too excited, that I'm free to be able to kind of say let's stop. But I think part of the pleasure is going to be to hear their passion about what comes through in their book and about what it is that they've done, is they've done their best to help their children with autism. So to lead off, Mary, tell us about your book, about your journey, about how things have gone and what you want people here to know.
Well, first of all, I have to ask, where were you when my son was diagnosed? Yeah. I wish I had had a physician with your open-mindedness, with your compassion, because that is so missing in our medical community at large. And so our experiences mirrored what every other parent has been going through, where you're given the diagnosis and then you're sent off into the hallway to grapple with the fact that they just told you that your child is going to end up in a group home or an institution one day. And so when you're hearing those words as a parent and you're reeling from that, you're not even thinking, oh my gosh, my life is over. You're thinking about the child. And as parents of children with autism, we're not just thinking about, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to him in the future. We're looking at the child in pain today. Mm-hmm. So when your child is writhing on the ground in agony, banging their head on the wall, self-injurious, smearing feces on the wall, things of that nature, you really aren't even thinking about prognosis. You're thinking, how do I help my child's pain today? What does that mean to the next parent? What does that mean to me? So that's where I went. My son was in pain. My son was in agony. I didn't care what the heck they called it. All I knew was that it was going to be up to me to figure it out, because the physicians gave me the no hope, no cure, he just has autism. So I got that. We had he was diagnosed by 2 neurologists, 3 psychologists, neuropsychiatrists. So he ran the gamut. He was very severe. So when people say, you know, now that my child is now recovered, and I'll talk about that in a minute, that maybe he wasn't diagnosed properly in the first place, I go, how bad could they, how incompetent could they be to have that many people misdiagnose him? So I was dealing with a child who by the age of 16 months had sensory issues, gastrointestinal disorders. He had all the behaviors, but again, the behaviors were not as much as the issue as the fact that I was changing 20 green diarrhea diapers a day. The smell smelled like a barn animal made it. And as I'm trying to figure out how to help my child, he's falling off the growth curve. He's, you know, so there's just a whole gamut of physical issues that came simultaneous to the actual diagnosis that was coming from just the behaviors. So I became very motivated to dietary, even though I asked my physician, what do I do about the diarrhea? Go ahead and give him some crackers and milk, and maybe that'll help him. Of course, we now know that that's the worst thing you can do. So I actually ended up doing what my first job in research was. I Googled, and I Googled diet, autism, something or other, because I knew that something was correlating there. Because how do you keep looking at a kid who's obviously in pain and not realize that there's something that you as a mother have to do about it? And I ran across a book, and it's very famous now in the autism community, called Special Diets for Special Kids. And it's written by Dr. Lisa Lewis, whom I became friends with later, by the way, but I credit her. But so she writes this book, and it was just a simple book to just explain why taking out gluten and dairy actually helps children. So it was like 100 pages of understanding the science behind dietary intervention, and about the rest of it was all recipes. I'm like, I think I can do this. So within a week of my child starting just with dairy removal, I had a different kid. He stopped waking up from his naps, from screaming. He was, for an hour and a half, he used to do that. Behaviors got better. So I said, okay, well, maybe we're on to something. So then I stumbled and failed badly trying to remove the gluten. So after 8 months of miserably doing this, I bit the bullet, and for three solid weeks, we were gluten-free, dairy-free. And my kids started to improve, I mean, like significantly. So I'm thinking, well, maybe that really wasn't the diet, because basically I didn't want to do it, you know. Okay, so you know that when I preach to everybody else, it's coming from the perspective of I was in your shoes, I didn't want to do it either. So as I started down that path, I fed him a little bit here and a little bit there of all the gluten crappy food that I used to give him, and he went into full board regression. He was banging his head on the wall. He chipped his tooth on the floor. He was screaming in agony. And I can't believe I did this, but I actually brought him still to OT, occupational therapy. And I dropped him off, and the occupational therapist is like, oh my God, what happened to him? He lost 6 months of progress overnight. Did you give him a new drug? And I'm like, yes. And the drug is food. And I am an awful mother. And I'm going to tell you something. That particular day, nobody could have talked me out of that fact that I had failed my son. And just that feeling of failing your child motivates any parent, okay? And I know every mother out there knows this feeling, that guilt, that overwhelming guilt. I no longer was going to be bargaining with what I had to do. I catapulted to finding the answers, called my husband up and says, I'm going shopping and I'm about to spend a lot of money and you just need to know. So that began the journey. I was out of denial. I was out of bargaining and guilt. And I talk about the grief cycle, by the way. The grief cycle is part of this process of getting the parents on board with who they have to become in order to be that final tool that gets their child well, because it is the proactive parent that is able to lead the way on better health for not just their child with autism, but their entire family. So that's what started it for us. And I don't know if I'm supposed to jump to the conclusion here. Okay, thank you. Okay. Conclusion is, because I got engaged in this process of getting educated, of reaching out to other parents, of consulting any expert that I could on this, and I'm talking about physicians, therapists, anybody that I could, and hanging out with other proactive parents, that was key too. I found the answers. I say I, meaning we landed into the physician who's made the difference. It was IVIG. We did immunoglobulin therapy, plus we also did every other therapy you can imagine out there. But that was the magic bullet for us. It wasn't the end all. So we use the word recovery to describe a child who's no longer symptomatic of autism. Okay. Now, he's not cured, because he still has to fight immunological issues, the scars that autism left behind that we're still continuing to mend, as he will forever be dietary intervention. So we talked about that. And that's the way to keep his immune system healthy. So we still do that. The point is, by the age of 4, he was considered asymptomatic. He went from what they call an ATEX score, which is kind of the gauge of how severe is your child. It goes from like 0 to 136. He was a 104. By the age of 4, he was down to a 4, considered recovered. Okay? So as the school district is looking at it, going, we've never done this before, but he went from autism spectrum disorder to just speech delay. So they never did the opposite. So we went from 27 hours a week down to 2, and then eventually by the time that he went to middle school, he was no longer IEP. Today he is a junior in high school, 3.75 GPA. Friday we go for our first college tour, by the way. He's already told me exactly what he wants to do. But he's typical enough, and I got to tell you this, and this is a proud mom moment. I know you guys don't but the proud mom moment for me was he got grounded. I mean, like, for being a stupid teenage boy. So as I'm yelling at him, going, what the hell were you thinking? On the other hand, I'm thinking, thank God, I get to ground my teenage son for being a stupid teenager. Do you know how many mothers out there would love that opportunity to ground their kid for being typical? So I had that gift. I don't tell him it was a gift, by the way, but I had that gift, and I never took that for granted. So I've continued to stay, obviously, very active in the community, because the next parent needs to know that it's possible. That as they get engaged in this process, their kid can become that typical kid, too.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Good. Next, Marcia.
I'm Ryan's mom, and that's my big claim to fame. And I'm very different. I did things very different than Mary did. And we have two different journeys, but we both got it done. So I think it's really important for people to realize there's more than one way to do this. And for me, when you say autism, that's just a collection of symptoms that we try and put together to put a name on something, you know, that's different in every kid. Each kid does it differently. And my son is now an aerospace engineer. I was told he would never be okay, and he would have to be put in an institution. And like Mary, I've heard the same thing. Well, he must have not really been severe. Well, I was there. He was severe. You know, there was no question. And my goal in doing all of this is I want other parents who come behind me to know that it's very treatable. And if you do the treatments, things can change. Now, having said that, not everybody can be helped, because if their immune system is too compromised, they may not be able to get the same kind of fixes that my kid did. So equal effort doesn't always mean equal outcome. But most kids, when you treat their immune system medically, they do improve, and many can completely recover, like Ryan did. And for me, I used to love it when he got in trouble, too. I mean, we're just crazy. We don't see the world the same as anyone else. I remember the night that he got his driver's license. My husband comes walking into the room, and he says, I just had to yell at him to get off the phone with a friend. And I had to tell him, you know, that he shouldn't be doing that. And he says, isn't that fabulous? Mm-hmm. It wasn't that great, you know, so we sort of see things in a different way. We see things, you know, that other parents would think were, you know, just nothing as wonderful. And so that is really important. So for me, it's really important also to use whatever works. Mary did everything very naturally and very, I don't know. We weren't quite that way. Ryan still takes antivirals and antifungals to help his immune system continue to work, and he's still dependent on that, and he hates that. He wishes he didn't have to do it. But for him to have a normal life, that's what is needed, so we will do it. We'll do whatever it takes.
Hi.
That's wonderful. Our journey is probably, our son now is 24, so I think about our journey start when it was starting, going into the basement of our home, and I had this old computer, and it's not like it is now where you can, you know, be a Google doctor or sit there and become an expert by reaching out and finding myriad of services, a lot of professionals working in the field of autism. In our state, we're from Michigan, so in our state there was only actually two doctors at that time that diagnosed autism. Our son, we were very lucky, we had our older son was 16 months older than our son with autism. And so we kind of had a little litmus test of what was, you know, quote-unquote normal behavior or quote-unquote, you know, what was expected for development. Our son actually, though, developed very rapidly as an infant and toddler and then regressed rapidly at the age of 2 years old. He was perfectly fine, very healthy child. His Apgar scores were normal when he was born. There wasn't any indicators for the first 18 months of his life. So we came from a kind of like a, you know, doing very well. My husband and I, as has been indicated, we were both police officers in the city of Detroit at that time, which was the Myrtle capital of the United States. So, you know, that was, you know, we would go to work, and when our son regressed,
Very rapidly he became sick. Very rapidly he became self-abusive, abusive to his brother, abusive to us physically. Very challenging behaviors, very challenging. So we were desperate for a diagnosis. And we were didn't have many things for resources at that time. And we would go to work, and I tell this story, and it sounds horrible, but we would go to work to relax. 8 hours of handling runs that were murders, rapes, crimes in progress, because we didn't do report writing back then. We were actively responding to calls that were active crimes in progress. But our home was in an uproar, basically. We had a child that was very sick, and we had no resources, and we had no options. You know, this was 22 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when I say I went in that basement every time those kids went to bed. But my son would wake up between 2 and 5 o'clock every day and be like the Tasmanian devil. He was crawling on top of furniture, trying to get out of every door, every window of our home. And my husband and I worked opposite shifts as police officers to be able to meet his needs and the needs of his older brother. So what basically happened was I realized this wasn't going to get done unless we did it. So we sought out every type of information, everything initially possible. And after the 3 months of his diagnosis, I was almost killed in a car accident going to work. And I suffered a very bad traumatic brain injury and a broken leg. So my husband would have to lock us in our family den because our son wasn't a loper, he was a wanderer. And what happened was kind of like a little miracle. I was recovering from my brain injury. I could not speak. I could not spell. It was very difficult for me because I'm an A-type personality. I like to be perfect. I want to be able to, keep up with the Joneses in the neighborhood, right? But my husband was locking us in the room every day to go to work to keep us safe because I had a full leg cast on. I wasn't able, like I said, my cognitive ability was not there. So what happened was I actually remediated my brain injury and remediated my son at the same time. I found out about how the brain functions, what was transpiring for him and his brain and what was transpiring for me and mine to actually heal us both. And it was almost like this was meant to happen. So when I went back to work, it was kind of like missing it, being at home with the kids, not the lock being locked in a room, obviously, right? Because our son actually did escape once. And I tell that story to parents and when I advise them on eloping and wandering, which is something that affects over half of the population of kids with autism. Mm. And I say, no matter what you do, you have to be so careful. He actually climbed up and went out a window that was almost two stories, and I had to race after him in a full leg cast to catch him as he was going over a neighbor's fence. We lived on one of the busiest streets in Detroit, and I knew if he got over that fence that he was going to die. So I threw my body. I mean, that's what we did as moms, right? But I tell that story because it's really important when you share these experiences, because people always say, this is so hard, this is so challenging, and I almost died. And I can't imagine what would have happened. And I thank God every day that he kept me alive. Because since that day, I knew that he was our mission. Both our sons were our mission. And we wanted to effect systems change to ensure that parents after us did not feel so helpless. They were able to have hope. And I share my story because I say, I was there. I could hardly think when I was trying to research for my son. My brain wasn't functioning right, but I got it together because I knew if I didn't get it together, that was it. Since then, he's progressed very well. We fought. He was the first child in a general education setting with autism in our school, in our neighborhood elementary school. My husband and I had been volunteers in that school for a while for our older son. And we knew we were laying the seed, right? You know, when you go in there, you got to be able to lay that foundational basis. They still treated like he was walking through the door with two heads because he was different. He was a different type of a child. He was his needs were different than the other ones that needed to be educated in the school. But everything we did for him benefited every single child in the classrooms he was in because we simplified tasks. We simplified the way he learned, and he was doing it. And he was doing it because his peers in the classes were helping him. So he actually created an environment within that school. By the time he left at sixth grade, the principal said to us, you know, your child changed the school. It wasn't me as a mom. It was him. And he always was very determined within the things he did. He never saw himself as being a child with a disability. He never saw himself as being less. He knew he was different, but he was never less. He never thought that he could not do something. So as he progressed through the system, and we also, he was receiving services through Medicaid in the state of Michigan, so he had a Medicaid waiver. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, how we changed the system to adapt to children with autism. Because when he entered the system and in that program, it wasn't really beneficial for kids like him. So we worked to change it and develop it into the best waiver program in our county and the whole country. We did things that were out of the box. We did things that people protested for initially. But when we could establish a need set, the actual needs of the children that have autism, and say these types of interventions are going to help that child, these types of intervention are going to make them less dependent on the system, more community-based, and we are going to make their life, their quality of life, better. That's the kind of thing that we did. And that's the kind of thing we're still doing. Our son right now still has a waiver, a Medicaid waiver. He's an adult. He has a HAB waiver. His supplements and vitamins are currently being paid for by Medicaid. That is something, and you know, if you can get something like that done, Medicaid's the gold standard in our country. It requires medical necessity. So when our son's 14 different supplements and vitamins he takes on a monthly basis or daily, you know, whatever he needs, is deemed a medical necessity by his neurologist, his attending MD, and then his whole treatment team, and then that's put into his individual plan of service through a person-centered plan on an annual basis, and Medicaid is funding it. So that's the type of thing that we've been doing. That's the type of a mountain we've been climbing, but we're pulling people with us. And I'm one of those types of moms, and I say I advocate, I support a lot of different moms across the country, and I say, I'm not going to do this work for you. I'm going to do this work with you. And you are going to become empowered to be the next me, because I'm not going to live forever. We, us women up here, and even Dr. Hendren, we're not going to be around forever. You're going to be the next people that, and please don't chip away at the foundation we created.
Yes.
That took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And just because you're able to access a lot of information now as a young mom, and you were talking about your son, there's so many things available now. I almost think it's a detriment. There's almost too much information. There's almost too much out there. And parents are like searching, wanting every service. And one of the things that we were having a discussion earlier today, and I said, the one thing that I say to parents is you have to identify your child's need set. Don't be asking for every single service known to man because you think it's going to be better for your child. Identify what they need and then attach a service to it, or an intervention, or a medical, you know, some type of medical intervention. We've done pretty much, I can say, the gamut. You know, I was never chasing Lorenzo's oil, but I'm one of those moms that, and my husband's the same way, he's here today too, we don't want to leave any stone unturned. And I'm going to say this, and I'm sorry, but our son is doing really well. He was gone to college. He's doing really good, very independent young man. An amazing artist, but 2 weeks ago he's diagnosed with epilepsy. And this is something that everyone keeps telling me, I'm sorry. My brother had epilepsy, and that actually ended his life. And so that's why for us it was devastating. The neurologist called us on a Sunday because he knew what it was going to be like for us. And I said, well, no, it's another thing. It's not, you know, this is not a, it's not going to define him. It's not going to be a defeater. It's just another part of the game. You know, it's just another part of what we have to work toward, what he may live with and what he may not. But I do think it's something that we're going to identify what his need sets are. We're going to look at it. Is it biologically based? Is it organic? I mean, you don't typically develop seizures at age 24. My brother developed them when he was in puberty at age 12, and our son had a difficult time then too. But we also think it's there's something there, and that's what we're going to address. So, and I'm sorry, I started to cry. But it was just...
Could we do another round through?
Yeah, just, and I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, okay, so, but like I said, that's just another, you know, another little hill we're going to have to work through. So, but thank you. And I wanted to also thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting us, because I do think that this is something that's very important for us to be able to tell our stories, to inspire other people, and to know that things are happening within systems change. So, thanks, Bob.
Great, thanks. I want to just make a quick comment just as a kind of clarification, is that in my experience, there have been parents that have looked passionately for treatments and have looked in every kind of a way, and it's not been easy for them to find it. And I worry that when parents hear a story of somebody saying, my kid recovered from autism, or this made a big difference, then they feel, well, what did I do wrong? Why couldn't I do what that parent did? Or you'd say the casein gluten-free diet worked for you. And I've had some patients that have followed the diet religiously. I know they have for months or years, and it just hasn't worked for their kid. Where I know other parents that'll tell me it's the single most important thing that I did. It made a world of difference. And IVIG is something that has a lot of risks, and some people don't do well with those risks, and some people really do. And I guess that's the part of this that I think is admirable in your role in this, is that you kept searching and you kept trying to find something. And one of the questions that I had was just to go around, what is it that, when did you get to the point that, and we'll kind of go through each of you, that you finally said, I'm not going to find a doctor that's going to do this for me, or I'm going to have to go finding these things myself. How did you get to that point, and then how did you know how to take that on to carry on rather than just say, well, if the doctor said this, I guess that's what I need to take?
That's interesting you should ask that question, because I think when you go to an autism conference, even though you're surrounded by doctors, I mean, these are world-renowned physicians, researchers, movers and shakers out there. And yet every single one of those parents is allergic to the words, the doctor said. Mm. We don't like those words. Because we also had the doctors that said, your child is just going to have autism. Or they've said a lot of other inane things that sent us spiraling into despair, depression, whatever it is. Or they became the catalyst to say, I'm going to prove you wrong. And that's what our story was. It wasn't even so much what the diagnosis was, so the prognosis. All I knew was that it was up to me to find the answers to stop the pain. And in the process of trying to find the answers to stop the pain, we actually stopped the symptoms. So then you go down the path of, well, how far can we take this? So when you talked about the gluten, dairy-free, and the specifics, okay, what I found out, and this is what I wrote about, is it doesn't even matter what you choose to do. It's the fact is that you just need to get started. Once you start pulling that thread, you don't know where it's going to lead you. And so when I wrote the recovery chapter, which, by the way, I could have gone on and on and on, there was so many myriad of ways that families found their victory over autism. By the way, they're not all fully recovered, but their child has improved. Their family life is better. What did they have to do to get through it to make for sure that their family overcame the impact of autism? Again, whether another child was like mine and went on to a full and bright life, or the child was still moderately affected, but yet functional. I thought it was important to highlight that. What do these families do? None of them are the same. And I thought I thought it was important to highlight that. But the one common thread, they had a proactive parent. That is the only thing that we all have in common. And I wrote this story that the National Institute of Mental Health quantified that there was maybe about a fourth of the children can recover from autism. Now, my son was one of the candidates for that particular study, so I can tell you that it was very stringent as to how they selected the candidates for this particular study to quantify those who would be considered who had autism and then no longer do.
That was the Deb Fine study? another one?
The National Institute of Mental Health, the one that came out in January 2013. Mm-hmm. So my son was a candidate for it. I actually pulled him out of it because there were so many particulars. It was I was being challenged yet again on whether or not he actually had autism. We had all the documentation, but it wasn't enough for these researchers. But in my conversation with one of the lead researchers, Dr. David Black, he asked me what we had done, and we got into a conversation about how severe he had been. We had done the IVIG, and he says, oh, there's another child here who also recovered doing the same treatment. I go, well, you got to stop. I said, don't put a lot of stock as to what individual child did or what made a difference. If you focus on the therapy, you're not getting at the real key piece. And the real key piece, I says, the common thread that every one of those kids who've recovered had was a proactive parent. So whether they're recovered, improved, better quality of life, none of that happens, none of it, without the parent being involved.
I would add that you've also talked a lot about your family and how important it is to find ways that you keep yourselves all together.
Yeah. We're the collateral damage, and I think you guys all know what I'm talking about. Okay, so our families are suffering. This is not just affecting the child. This affects the typical siblings. This affects the marriages. It affects the health of the caregivers. So I wrote holistically about this because we all have to get through it. I explained that there's a grief cycle that you do go through that seems to be pretty unique to autism. And so I describe those cycles and how it shows up in our lives. But just identifying that it's going to happen or that it is happening actually puts a label on it so that you don't feel that you're alone and that what you're going through is abnormal. So the fact that you're going through some really difficult times and that you will come out of it seems to stop the despair along the way. And we are dealing with a lot of despair in our community. And that's the other part of the collateral damage. I talk about the marriage issues. And the reason why I do this is because there's this some wild statistic that 90% of our marriages fail. I never saw that. I counseled a lot of families. But I did see 100% of us going through hell. So our divorce rate really wasn't quite different because we were staying together because we really had no other choice. We couldn't afford to divorce. So there's a lot of things like this, but we were all going through very difficult times. The typical siblings also go through very difficult times, and that they're not spotlighted enough. And I chose a full chapter in this book dedicated to those typical siblings. How do we support them? Because the reality is that many of them are going to be the caregivers one day. How do we get them through this? Because they are also affected. So when I was being challenged by my agent and a publisher, they didn't want these typical siblings brought up. And I says, well, then I'm not going to write the book. So then there you go, because they are an equal part of this journey. So I made for sure that chapter was in there. And I've been really impressed with how parents and others have responded to that particular one.
That's
so
nice. Very
anyways,
nice.
I think I should probably...
Well, I have read Mary's book, and
she's
it's fabulous.
She is in my book.
I'm in her book. Yeah.
So is Carolyn.
And I always tell my parents, there's not very many books I recommend. One of them is Martha Herbert's Autism Revolution, and the other one is Mary's. And they have to read Mary's for chapter 5. I love chapter 5, so make sure you read chapter 5.
That's the one on marriage, by the way.
Yes. Oh, she's brilliant. She's brilliant in that particular chapter. And it is. It puts a tremendous stress on the family. The one thing that happened to us that I really noticed is, you know, when we got the diagnosis, you know, it's like they tell you there's no hope, there's no recovery, there's no cure, there's nothing you can do. You have this developmental disorder, and we'll just have to see how he turns out. And I remember the psychiatrist, who was the leading authority in Minnesota at the time, telling me that, well, if you're really lucky, he may be in the basement of some company, you know, with a computer and never having to deal with people. And she went on and on and on about all of this. And when we left that office after that day, my husband, who's right back there, we didn't even say anything to each other, but we knew we were never going back to that doctor. I mean, we never even talked about it, but we knew it because... You know, what she said was so devastating, and it was so awful, and it kept me going for years. When I didn't have any strength to keep going, all I'd do was conjure up the image of that day in her office where she was so awful, and so unfeeling, and so, you know, kind of like, well, we'll just have to see how he turns out. Well, not with my kid. We're not going to wait and see how he turns out. We're going to make things happen. And that was huge, because I'd get mad, and I'd get mad all over again, and then I could fight again. You know, sometimes I didn't have the energy to keep going. And that particular scene, I would play it over in my mind, and I thought, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you. And my husband was hysterical, because every time Ryan accomplished something amazing, he would write an email to this psychiatrist thanking her about what she did. And I put one of them in the book, you know, but it really is important that we keep going and we never give up, because nobody knows how things are going to turn out. I mean, I didn't know. And the other thing is that we look for someone to do this for us. I mean, I remember thinking, please, you know, let me find this doctor. And I went from doctor to doctor to doctor, and I wanted anyone to do this for me. And then I finally realized, you know what? Nobody wants my job. Nobody's going to do this. And we were, at the time, it was pre-internet. So, you know, I would go to the library. How funny is that? And get books. And I would spend all night reading. And most of them were not any help at all. They really weren't. I think you're right about now there's almost too much information, because it's confusing for parents. They don't know which way to go. And all you really have to do is read Mary's book and my book, and then you're done. You got it.
So while we're moving on to Carolyn for more comments, I'd ask that you write down if you have questions or things that you really hope that they might answer for you, and then we'll pick those up and be able to ask them. But Carolyn.
I think for us, the answer, I was, in a sense, I was lucky. That sounds terrible to say it, but I was lucky. I was a sibling of somebody that had a disability, so I had seen my parents struggle with trying to obtain services for my brother, and what it had done to our family. He would have, you know, full-blown seizure. We would be out at a restaurant, and he would start to undress after a seizure. And it was hard. It was hard growing up like that. He also would become very physical and assaultive to my parents after a seizure. And it wasn't something that, but the thing about it is that's your sibling. You know, I was never... was I embarrassed? Yes. But was I ashamed? No. He was my brother. And the same thing happened, you know, with our family. We went into the parking lot after the diagnosis, and we sat there and we cried. And because the doctor gave us nothing proactive to do, he gave us a diagnosis. He didn't tell us about anything. He didn't tell us about floor time, ABA, LOVAS, he didn't tell us about dietary. He told us nothing. He said our son would be institutionalized before he was 10, and he told us to concentrate on our older son. So we went in the car, and we cried, and Nick was in the back seat, in his car seat. And all of a sudden, and he was beautiful, such a beautiful child, everyone would always think he was a girl, just gold curls, just gorgeous baby. And we were sat there and cried. It was about 10 minutes. And all of a sudden, he just started to laugh, hysterically laugh. And we turned around, and we both looked at each other, and we said, we're not, you know, let's go home, because we got work to do, right? Let's go home. We got work to do. And it was the same type of thing. That doctor that did that and that gave us that diagnosis went on to become one of the leading experts through our children's hospital on autism. So every chance we could get, every advancement we could get, we would be like shuffling him by, you know, to see this is the child that you gave that diagnosis. I also talked to a mom, and this is what now, 20 years later, he said almost the same thing to a mom recently.
Yeah.
So that means to me we're not done.
Unfortunately, that's more the case.
We have work to do. And so, and like I said, that was probably, we've been through a lot of things in our lives, but I think that was one of the most devastating things. And within that, too, and we were talking about a single parent. My husband is an amazing guy. And I think I've met Frank, and I have met some fathers and parents as a duet kind of thing, doing the dance of who's going to do the therapy and what day. You know, my husband and I worked opposite shifts, so that would always be somebody there to take, you know, to go to therapy. We are also able to job share. So if I had to go to an important meeting that he may not have been comfortable doing, he could work for me. So we changed our entire lives around what was focusing on the needs of our two sons. We actually left our jobs and moved to a different area of the state to get better services for our son. And the thing that was ironic about that, he ended up going to a school 10 minutes away from where we used to live. In a different county, it was an hour and 15-minute bus ride each way. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that you, and I thought, I'm going to change that. So, of course, that was one of the things that I changed within the first year after we moved. He's not riding the bus for an hour and 15 minutes each way, because that was making him zone out or become aggressive. Or because who wants to sit? I don't want to sit on a bus for an hour and 15 minutes, right? So the thing about it is, and one of the things that I've discussed too in the past, and I always discuss with parents is, especially within your relationships with your other children and with your spouse and with your community members, is to always think about what's the best for your family as a whole. If things are going to harm your family, especially financially and things like that, you really have to look at the choices that you're going to make. Because it's a whole family dynamic. It's not only about the one child. And you really have to think, we were lucky. I tell people this. We had nothing paid for when our sons were going through this. I worked to pay for all the things that he was getting on the majority. He was our investment. We invested in him. We would do the same thing for our other son. And we did. We bought him. You know, 4 years at a state university for college. You know, those are the type of things. It was a give and take. But it was never to the point of where it was a detriment to our family, because you really have to weigh those types of things. And we were lucky that we were able to build a natural circle of support in our community, which is priceless. Because if you have neighbors that see your child, you know, out, you know, playing or whatever, or if you have somebody at church that your child might become upset and you may be doing something that's willing to step in for you, that's priceless. And that's the kind of thing that I tell parents, you really need to ensure that you have a natural circle of support of unpaid people to be there when you may not be there. And it's a priceless thing.
Well, you know, you talked about the siblings, mm-hmm. and I think it's really important that you make them part of the process. Mm-hmm. My daughter, when Ryan was little, no matter what I did, until we started the medical piece. Because interestingly enough, everything in my life that we did sort of led up to be able to help this kid. And my husband and I were both behavior therapists at UCLA for children with autism, okay, before we had one of our own. And that's kind of weird if you think about it. And I remember when we got the diagnosis, I called Dr. Lovas, because he was the one who started ABA and did everything, and I said, gee, you know, this happened. What do you think about these special diets and this and that? And he goes, well, you know, I took sugar away from these kids, and they weren't better. And I thought, you know what? You more than anyone, I didn't say it to him, of course, but you more than anyone should know that even if you fix what's wrong, if you could wave a magic wand and say, boom, you're normal, the kid would not be normal. You still have to catch them up on everything they missed. So the medical is the only thing that allows learning to happen. You know, it makes it so they can learn, but you need the behavioral piece as well. And for my daughter, when Ryan was little, he used to bite and squeeze her until she cried. And that was the first behavior that we had to address. And she'd say to me, hey, Mom, can I hit him? Can I defend myself? Mm-hmm. And I'd say to her, I said, honey, as soon as he's better, you can hit him. And, you know, it's still a big joke between them now. Whenever he ticks her off, she'll just turn around and slug him, you know. And then they both laugh because they know about that. But you have to make them part of the process. And we used to have Megan log in as a therapist. And I think I paid her something like 50 cents an hour. You know, don't turn me in for child labor laws. And she would work with Ryan teaching him pretend play. And she felt like part of the process then. And it was important for her. And interestingly enough, she is now a BCBA with the Lovas Institute. Okay. I mean, we've come full circle. And she now makes a difference. She makes me look like an amateur with doing ABA because this girl is gifted. And they can't understand why she's so good at it. And I thought, you know, she had her first behavior therapy lesson when she was 7 years old. So she's been living with this her whole life and does it naturally.
I'd like to take a break here just to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is being led by Dr. Robert Hendren from UCSF, psychiatry professor, and our panelists are Carolyn Gamicha, Mary Romanis, and Marcia Hines. So for our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I do have one question that has come to me from the audience and kind of a question I would like to address as well. One of the topics that when we were building this program, we were looking at the leadership role and the innovation role of each of you as women. And I think what that when you put those two together, we come up with collaboration. And I'd like each of you, including Dr. Hendren, to answer this question. How do you best work with doctors to get the very best of traditional medicine, but also to collaborate with them to bring new information to them? And how does this work both as an attempt to educate, but an attempt to collaborate with traditional and alternative medicine from your own experience?
You're going to have me go first? Yeah. You're the experts, I think.
You're going to start.
All right, okay. You know, both of the books talk about that kind of collaboration, how one forms a partnership. And it's interesting over years how medicine has, in certain ways, or physicians have started to redefine themselves in terms of saying who's in charge, whose word has to be followed. And I think we still see times where people have patients exit their practice because they don't follow what it is they say they ought to be doing. But I think for me, it's a pleasure to be invited to join a family. It's a huge honor to be able to be brought into that family and to then feel like I can be within the family thinking about what's the best thing for this family, not for me, but for the family, and how can we form a partnership to do that. I find there are less struggles. There's a way that I belong to a lot of different families. They're not all the family I would have or the way that I do it, but that way of having everybody be respectful and at some points kind of loving and to appreciate the person who's there and to be able to work together for me is now what I think makes medicine the most rewarding.
I'm going to repeat again, you're a rarity. I'm very serious about that because you are exactly the kind of physician we need in our community. I'm very serious. If you could give a course to your fellow physicians and psychiatrists, to let them know this is the kind of person and human being you need to be. You get more out of it when you have that patient collaborative. But what we find is we are often met with adversarial because we are coming in vested with information. We have a bunch of issues that we would like to go over, and many of them are not prepared. I'm not talking all of them, but a lot of physicians just don't have the time or the inclination to do the level of research that vested interest mothers in particular are doing. So I show up and I have got a binder, I've got a timeline, and I've had physicians have actually said, Mrs. Romanis, what is your medical background? Well, you see, doctor, I've got the laboratory living in my house. And that's exactly where it's coming from. I am more motivated to help my child. I am going to research, and I'm going to invest, and I'm going to go find the information, and I'm going to be regurgitating it back to you. So over the years, I've actually become really good at regurgitating information. So this gets back to when you introduced me and how am I talking to physicians. Somehow or other, I'm able to talk an element of their lingo in parent language.
Impressive.
Well, it's gotten impressive. To the point, however, that I've had to, when I'm mentoring them, I'm not mentoring them on the latest scientific research, nothing like that. I'm telling them what the parents are doing. So I have a lunch date with one of the physicians when I get back, and I said, I need you to know what the parents are researching these days, and I need you to be aware of how they're perceiving things, what's going on in the community, so that you are aware, so when these families come to you, what they're going to be asking you about. And that's really actually has worked out quite brilliantly. I've also mentored, and I've gotten the calls, though, from the physicians about their child. So I talk to them. I don't talk to them in medical vernacular. I talk to them about diet. I talk to them about what they're going to go through personally. I talk to them about a variety of issues that has nothing to do with medical. It has everything to do with what they are experiencing at this time that their own colleagues cannot help them with. And I'm talking to them as a parent. So that's how I've been able to bridge that. And the collaboration that has come is when the respect, like you mentioned, is there. The moment I have any physician, therapist, or whoever tell me it's their way or the highway, I choose the highway. Mm-hmm. And I tell every parent out there, choose the highway. If you ever meet that, that means that you are no, somehow or other, they have made themselves in charge. You're the one that's in charge of the team. And you need to make sure that you continue to assert that everywhere you go. So that's what we do.
Good comment.
Well, I think that everybody has a piece of the puzzle. It takes parents, it takes doctors, it takes behaviorists, it takes teachers, it takes everybody working together. And what happens sometimes is egos get in the way. Oh. And this man doesn't have one, and that's what we love about him. But there are so many doctors who say, you know, I had people tell me, well, if you do that, I can't work with you. You know, if you, you know, that's dog training. You don't want to do that, you know. If you do that, and it's funny because the person, the doctor who helped my son the most, who I no longer recommend, by the way, he was so against so many of the things that I thought needed to be done. When my son was in first grade, he had constant strep, and we couldn't get rid of it, and it was a big drain on his immune system. And I made the decision that we were going to have his tonsils and adenoids out. And I swear his wife will thank me because he used to snore like a freight train. You could hear him all over the house. And I remember going to the doctor and saying, hey, I think we should do this. And he says, oh, no, you don't want to do that. And I had to trust my gut. And I had to trust the local doctor who, I mean, we lived in Minnesota. His autism doctor lived in California. And I had to trust my gut to know that that was the right thing to do. And so parents, I tell them all the time, trust your instincts.
That's right.
You know your kid best. You know what works for them. And having those tonsils out was a major, major bump for Ryan because it took a lot of stress off of his immune system. So I just think we all need to work as a team. And sometimes the behaviorists don't think the medical is important. And the medical makes it possible for the kids to learn. So, you know, we have to put it all together, all the different pieces. And it's the moms and dads who are in charge. You're the one who are going to make a difference in your child's outcome.
Carolyn.
You both have discussed the things that we kind of, our journey was very similar. We actually kind of stumbled into, we waited a year to go after the diagnosis of our son to a specialist. He was one of the leading specialists in the country. We waited a year the week before he went on sabbatical, our appointment. So we met the neurologist that was going to take his place, and she was wonderful. She's been with our son since that time. For many years, over almost now approaching 18 years, and she kept him as a patient, even though she's a pediatric neurologist, because we took everything we took to her. She knew I would research it, weigh the pros and cons. We would discuss it, and then, you know, she was writing me scripts for HBOT. She was writing me scripts for things like secretin when doctors, you know, that was one of the first medical treatments for autism many, many years ago. She trusted the research we did. We would discuss things. She would always tell me, I trust your intuition. I trust what you're doing. And I told her, you know, thank you very much, because without her and those scripts, within the different things, the systems change we did through Medicaid, it would have not transpired. She was writing those scripts. A neurologist, a mainstream neurologist, she was writing the scripts for us for over-the-counter vitamins and minerals and supplements, and also for therapy. She wrote a script for us for we had to take our son out of school at one point and put him in a private school because of some challenges the district had educating him. It wasn't our son. It was the district that had challenges. We put him in a private school. It cost us $15,000. We traveled 120 miles per day. She wrote us a script so we could take it as a tax deduction. That's how much she believed in him. We also had a team, Dr. Kathy Lord, who is one of the national experts on autism. She would call in for his IEPs. And she would say, you know, they wouldn't even know who she was. I hate to say it, the school psychologist didn't even know who she was. And here she was. She wrote the book, Educating Children with Autism. So, you know, she would call. I mean, we were lucky because we invested in the professionals. Like Mary had said, if the people didn't agree, I would listen. And I would listen to why they thought that something wasn't appropriate. I would research it more. Then I would fire that person. And I tell parents,
I love it.
You hire your doctors, and you can fire them.
Mm-hmm.
We're not slaves to our professional medical professionals. Well, I hate to say it like that, but one of the things I ask every professional that comes on board our son's team, and now to treat our family, because we have realized the genetic predisposition. We have a specific type of gene. My husband and my other son are different than myself and our son that has autism. So we have to treat differently. We've been very lucky to bring on board a medical professional, an MD now. And one of the first questions I asked her in interviewing her and before we started to see her is, are you going to be willing to testify in a Medicaid fair hearing if they try to question what we're doing? And I hate to say that, but we have to ask those types of questions. And the last one I won. I didn't need an attorney. I won myself. They were questioning his glutathione, his melatonin, his DMG. And a social worker was questioning that, not a medical professional. Because they said that that was, quote-unquote, alternative medicine. It wasn't. His medical doctor prescribed those. So when you have that type of a thing, and this is how we're changing the system. When you can sit there and say, and doctors no longer fear the fact that they're doing complementary. I don't like to call it alternative. I call it complementary medicine because I don't think it's alternative. I think it's what's necessary.
Integrative is another term.
Yeah. So
well, you know, and another thing. Oh, I'm sorry.
You know,
I think is really important is that. Whatever you try, it doesn't have to be forever because God allows U-turns, okay? I used to think I had to get it right the first time, you know, and if I got it wrong, then he wouldn't be okay. And you got to take some of that pressure off of yourself. You know, you try it. If it doesn't work, you try something else.
Good. Well, we only have time now for one last question, and I am going to ask it to all of you. We have had a number of people who maybe have had quite a different opinion of what you guys are doing. And Dr. Hendren, the Mind Institute that you're involved with, and all of you ladies, there have been some questions, and this one last question that's very pointed, asking, hey, aren't some of these things that you guys are trying absolutely unscientific, unproven? In fact, this quote here, Dr. Hendren, can you comment on the fact that the Mind Institute considers several of the therapies mentioned, IVIG, for example, unscientific. Where's the science? So I would like, we're out of time, we're almost out of time now. I'd like maybe each of you, so that we don't have a program, part of bringing Dr. Hendren in here tonight was to have a balanced program. And if each of you can comment on this and address this issue of unscientific, unproven, and address it with maybe a little bit of respect, less respect than maybe the question itself is asked.
Well, I think I understand the nature of that question. So let me just be clear. My son's IVIG was prescribed by a medical physician. Now, they didn't do it for autism. They did it because his immune system was destroyed. So he had all the biomarkers that said he's a candidate for IVIG. So that's the reason why we made that particular decision. It had nothing to do with autism. So the fact that it helped his autism was a bonus. but we were after repairing his destroyed immune system. Okay, so that's where we went with that one. So the other part of the question is, what do you say when you have to have all this back up the science? So one of the physicians that we did see, he's the head of an allergy immunology, the same one that asked me what was my medical background. And he says, well, you know, Mrs. Romanis, we really need to have more studies, more double-blind placebo studies. And I says, we don't have time. Those things take 20 years. I says, we've got kids that are suffering now. So the parents are going to be leading the way. And by the way, by the time you guys catch up, we've already done it. And he says, you know, I kind of think you have a point there. The reality is we don't care. We don't care. We're taking care of the kids today. The child, my child in front of me, I'm taking care of the kids. If I'm going to have to wait 20 years for somebody else to say, yeah, what you thought you were going to do 20 years ago is actually okay to do now. I don't need you. I need to know what to do for my kid today, and I as the mother know intuitively what I need to be doing. And by the way, this is not just medical. This is your educational. This is your therapies. This is anything that seems like it makes sense to you to help your child in any format, whether it's your typical kid or your special needs kid. That's what you do. Follow your intuition, because it's more on the money than the double-blind placebo studies that are going to take years in the making. So there you go. That's my.
And I have to agree with that. If I would have waited for everything to be proven, Ryan wouldn't be okay today.
Yeah, my son wouldn't be going to college if I had to wait for somebody else to give me their blessing. And by the way, what other grounds would I have lost in the process of having to get validated by somebody else who had some sort of a degree?
Well, and we, unlike Mary, we used some pretty heavy-duty drugs, you know, antivirals and antifungals, and he still takes them today. He gets blood tests to make sure that, you know, it hasn't hurt any of the organs in his body or anything else. But the thing is that a lot of people are really against that. And for me, at that point, I had to make a choice. Am I going to take a risk and help my kid, or am I going to wait, you know, and see what happens? And I knew for him to have any kind of a life, there was going to be some risk involved. But what I didn't realize at the time is, you know, I'm reading all these things about the side effects of, you know, Diflucan or Nizoral, and it can do this and that to the liver. And if I had listened to those, I wouldn't have used that. And what I didn't understand is that's what God made blood tests for. The blood tests will show you if it's doing any damage before any permanent damage actually happens. So, you know.
I would say quickly that I know that our time is up, that randomized controlled trials are really the best way we have to know whether something is working. I've been part of a lot of those, and I've guessed wrong, where I've thought a kid was doing a lot better and they were on a placebo, and I think parents have as well. So we really have to know what we're doing makes a difference. There's a couple of us here from a school where we're doing randomized controlled trials of some of these treatments. There's a group of us from UCSF that are here that are doing good science and looking at ways that we can pull this together. So I understand a parent saying, I can't wait. And we talked before about John Poling, who told me all the things he'd tried with his daughter, Hannah. Mm. I said, John, I can't believe you tried. It's a neurologist that was trained at Hopkins. I said, how could you do that? And he said, my little girl's got autism,
and
I'm not stopping at anything to figure that out. And I understand people trying it, but I hope they can form a partnership with their physician to say, what are the risks? What are the benefits? What are we looking for? What's our target? Right. What's a mechanism? If there's no mechanism, then you have to say, ooh, that's not good either. So I think by having a good partnership with our physicians and the scientists and the other people that are doing these things, I think we can move the field ahead.
We are.
I wanted to just say, I just wanted to say one thing. I think it's important, too. We participated in a lot of research, and you probably did, too. Over the years, our son was involved in probably 8 to 10 research studies because we didn't want to wait. And there always has to be that first person. Mm-hmm. And I hate to say it like that, but you can't. But the practice of medicine is practice. You're practicing it. You know, I hate to say it like that. It sounds kind of snippy.
Well, it's an art, and it's not a science.
It sounds a little snippy. Yeah. But the thing is, we do believe in research. When my brother died, he had epilepsy. We donated his brain to the Autism Tissue Program. We're very invested in research and science, and our son has participated. And I always tell parents, if you can participate in studies and in research, this is the thing that's going to change. It's right. going to affect systems change. Another thing that is very important, I think, is honoring both sides of this discussion. Within it, we really shouldn't be pointing fingers at what you may think is wrong. How about let's work towards what's right? And for every child with autism, it's not going to be the same thing. Right. You know, I sometimes people say, you know, and I feel so bad in comparing it to any other disability category, but autism is really it's a very different type of disorder. And now we're finding, you know, every day almost on the internet, I see research studies that are coming out and say, well, there was one the other day about vitamin B12. Our son had vitamin B12
We've been doing
shots
that for years.
15 years ago.
Yeah. Parents led the way on that.
So I'm like,
and I just did a randomized control trial that's being published next month that showed methyl B12 works.
Right. I'm proud of that. And I was one of the moms earlier this year that was fighting for medical marijuana use for pediatric use in the state of Michigan, the first state to get it passed, for pediatric use for kids that are beating themselves up and for having various challenging behaviors. We testified, and our board, our medical marijuana review board, voted, you know, 6-2 in favor of it. And the person in control in the state, our Laura Director Zimmerman, denied access. So these are the types of things. And I believe me, I know the science is still out there on medical marijuana. I know that. But I also know that people are, it's making their lives, the quality of life, better. And for these children that are, and I can say this, they are having very significant challenges, especially with both some with kids with seizures too, that in some states they can't get access to medical marijuana. But when you talk about it, people look at you like you're some hippie or some. I enforced illegal marijuana laws for 21 years. So you're looking at somebody that knows both sides of this coin. And when I was up there, they're like, whoa. You know, and my husband came too, and he's still an active officer. And, you know, that's the kind of thing people question, you know, they look at us like, whoa. Mm-hmm. You know, we've done the research. I've looked at the science. Our research for that argument, 400 pages of scientific studies.
Well, and I have to say, I totally believe in science as well. With Ryan, we did something called a neurospect before we actually started treating his immune system. And that shows, you know, inflammation in the brain. It shows if blood flow is cut off to any parts of the brain. And after, 2 years later, we repeated the test, and it showed much improved blood flow. Blood flow means function. And if you can make the inflammation go down, and I want to tell you about something that's on the horizon. I just heard of a company that's working on something to reduce brain inflammation. And I think that will have tremendous impact for all kinds of disorders. Things that we think are psychiatric that I don't really think are psychiatric at all. It's going to make a difference. And they're starting with Huntington's, you know, not with autism, but, you know, it will move. It will happen. And we just need it to happen faster.
Good. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time now. Dr. Hendren, you opened the program. Would you like to give one last closing remark for us?
It's been a pleasure to be here and share ideas with these three admirable ladies. The things that they've done for their kids has been great. And I think I would look forward to hearing more from people in the audience. I think there's a big audience of people that are trying desperately to find what things can make a difference, and they're finding some. And, you know, the way we advance science is we start off with an individual case report, an anecdote, and it leads to a case series, and that leads to a randomized control trial. So we don't go directly there. We do it a step at a time, and the kinds of experiments you've been doing are the things that lead science ahead. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hendren, and thank you to our panelists. Our program tonight has been Women Leading Healthcare Innovation and Family Recovery with our moderator, Professor Robert L. Hendren from the UCSF Department of Psychiatry, Carolyn Gamicha, Mary Romanis, and Marcia Hines. So with that, I would like to close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened public discussion. This program is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.